5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello everyone, and welcome to The Power of Music Thinking. My name is Christoph Zürn, and this is the podcast for people with a musical heart and a wicked job. We're looking for stories, insights and tools from the big world of music to inspire leaders and followers to listen, tune, play, and perform in whatever field you're operating. How does self-observation make you a better performer? How can touching from a distance help you with performance problems? Today, we speak with Jennifer Roig van Coley, violinist, healer, coach, author, and creator of the Art of Freedom method for conscious living and masterful artistry. We discuss methods like the Alexander technique, the Suzuki method, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, and how they benefit everyone who has to rehearse and perform, whether in music or business. And Jennifer shares her experiences as a solo artist, the challenges of keeping up great performances, and insights from her number one Amazon bestseller, Make Great Music with Ease, where she provides deep insights and lasting solutions to the challenges musicians face, including pain, performance nerves, and emotional stress. Okay, let's get into it. Welcome, Jennifer. Welcome to The Power of Music Thinking.
Hello, Christoph. Thank you so much for having me here.
Hey, where are you now at the moment? In the US, but in what place?
Yes, I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is in the Midwest, and it's a pretty middle-of-the-road place in pretty much every way, but it's pleasant. I like it here. We've been having some strange weather. I have to say, I don't appreciate the weather right now. Yesterday, we had some tornado watches all day, so I had to be prepared to go down into the basement, which is not my favorite thing to do.
Wow, unbelievable. I don't want to imagine to have to go to the basement.
No, it's not fun when that happens. The sirens go off and you have to watch your radar, make sure everything's charged and you have water and food down there. Thankfully, nothing has ever happened to me, and hopefully nothing ever will. It's not fun.
Oh, talking about a tornado, how does it sound? Is there a lot of wind going on before, or what's the difference? Or is it?
Well, again, I've never heard one and I hope to never hear one, but I'm told that it sounds like a train. So a train is like going right by where you are, and it's very loud. And if the sirens go off, you may only have a minute to take shelter. They can happen very fast. So Wow. If there's a tornado watch, you kind of want to get prepared and just be ready to drop everything and go to the basement if you're lucky enough to have one.
Wow, 1 minute. That sounds scary.
A little bit.
About tornado. Talking about tornado, what was your first sonic experience or album or record or performance that had an impact on you?
Well, I have to say I don't remember it, but I imagine I had lots of sonic experiences when I was in my mother's womb because she was a cellist. And she still is a cellist, but mostly plays clarinet now. But she was playing her cello when I was a little baby in her belly. And, that beautiful big instrument up against the belly, I can imagine must have had a pretty strong effect on me in there. And so I'm sure that was one of my first experiences. And of course, the mother's heartbeat is always there. Now, as for the first musical experience as a child, I have to say I do not remember that either. But I'm told by my parents that I used to sit up listening to them play chamber music in our home, in our living room. and that I told my mother when I was two that I needed a violin because I just loved to listen to them play chamber music. But as I said, I don't really remember that. That's just the story that's been passed down to me. I finally did get a violin when I was four. I had to wait a couple years.
So not a cello. So the violin still it is.
No, that's actually kind of interesting too, that, you know, in a string quartet, you'll have a cello and a viola and two violins. And I don't know if it's a person's personality that gets attracted to an instrument or if an instrument shapes the personality. I don't know how that works really, but I liked that violin. And I've always been the type of person that appreciates melodies. And I guess I liked the higher pitch. The violin is a lot like a voice also.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the cello is more like a male voice, isn't it? Like from the range, it's a little bit lower in sound.
That's right. I suppose I never thought of it that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
I think I heard that the cello would be the most that comes close to a man's voice. And I don't know if the violin, because if it goes very high, if this is typical. By the way, thinking about the music played and listened from out the womb, there's one episode with Mike van der Namer, and he's telling the story that he once came back from school, from music lesson, and he said, "I heard the nicest music I ever heard in the world." And then it was, I think it was a piano concerto from Chopin. And then the mother smiled and said, "You know, that's what I heard when I was pregnant with you."
Oh, really? That's
so
amazing.
So there must be a connection But talking about a sonic experience, what do you think? What was the first time that your ears were, let's say, on, that you thought, "Hey, wow, that sounds nice"?
I don't remember. I really don't. Music has been so much a part of my life since, you know, like I said, before I was born. And both of my parents were musicians. They're both retired now. But both of them were very active and still are very active in music. I came home from school every day and heard the cello. My mom was teaching Suzuki method at home. And I was often bored in school. So when I was finished with my work, which usually happened pretty quick, then I would daydream thinking about my violin pieces. I would be preparing for an upcoming violin lesson or a competition or some kind of performance. I had a lot going on as a child from a very early age. So music was just always there. And I can't remember a first experience at all. I was part of a group though, and I'm sure that had a big impact too. As I said, I wanted a violin when I was two, but my parents had never heard of anybody playing anything so young. And it wasn't until age four that my mother first heard of the Suzuki method. And so she sought out a teacher for me. And a big part of that method is having a group experience with other kids, even before you can play anything on your instrument. You're getting together with other kids every week, just doing fun games together with your instrument. And then the rest of the week, besides your private lesson, the original form of the Suzuki method was very much about what was called the mother tongue method. And the mother, I mean, it could be the father too, but in, you know, traditionally it was more the mother who would be at home with the child and learning the instrument along with them. So my primary teacher was pretty much my mother every day, you know, learning the violin along with me. She was a cellist, but then she would be, you know, learning the violin from scratch along with me. And she became very inspired by the whole method, and she learned how to teach the cello with that method. Ended up going to Japan to study with Suzuki, and then brought me to Japan to study with him. So it was a really all-encompassing experience that was both in the family and also a community fun thing that I would do with other kids.
That's very special, that Suzuki method. And, you know, if there are listeners that are not so much into music and music learning, they would imagine Suzuki to being just the car. So I think it's in the same way. But right. The method itself, it was really spectacular. And also the way in learning. So not just starting with the scale. So first learn the scales and then you can master the instruments. It's a different approach. It's more having fun, making it a natural part of your body and communicating.
That's right. I mean, the two main principles that come to my mind about the Suzuki method are the one that I already mentioned, the mother tongue method, where Suzuki compared learning music or learning the language of music to learning your mother tongue, your first literary language, so to speak, right? So just like you learn how to speak your language from your early caregivers, your mother or father, whoever, you're learning by listening and imitating. You don't learn how to read first, and you're not learning the alphabet first. You're learning meaningful words that are about communication. And so that's what Suzuki started to apply to creating his method for how to learn music. It was not about learning notes or scales or techniques. It was about let's experiment with this and imitate and learn by ear. And then later you learn how to read, just like with a language. And the other principle was a book of his is called Nurtured by Love, which is at the core of the whole technique also, where why are you making music? Why are you speaking? It's because you want to communicate. And ultimately, I think we all want to communicate love in some way, deep down. I think that's why we communicate, although it gets a little distorted sometimes in our communication. But that was his ideal and what he wanted to convey with this method. And I think a beautiful thing that also has gotten distorted over the decades since he first invented it, which actually was quite a while ago now.
And it's so beautiful because it's like really learning, like learning to walk. And by the way, now I really understand that my question of your first sonic experience, you know, if there's always music, it's like asking a fish from how's the water? So
yes, exactly.
So excuse that question here, that part.
Oh, it's a great question. It's fun to think about it.
Yeah, it's my standard question. And it gives me also some kind of indication in what direction our conversation can go. And I really love what you just explained about the Suzuki method. And also if people are in education. So the question is, how do you learn people something, or how do you facilitate them to learn something? How would you do this in a company?
Yes.
Would it just work along, or like in a craft where you have the master and the apprentice and you just try to work together and at a certain moment? So I think that's a beautiful way to start getting into music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are lucky to have music. I think a lot of people, musicians and non-musicians, can fall into the mistake of taking music for granted. You know, music is everywhere. You go into a restaurant and there's music. You go into a shopping mall and there's music. You turn on the radio or a TV show or a movie and there's music. It's always there. Not always, but it's become such a commonplace thing that it's really easy for us to, you know, not notice it or take it for granted. But it's a really essential part of the experience of being human. I mean, all of us have music inside of us. I think everyone's really a musician. We all sing. We're all dancers too. We move. We move to music. And I think it's a natural thing that it would be good to appreciate more. Absolutely. It doesn't mean we have to be professionals. It's just let's open up our ears and appreciate what's there, what we can do to communicate that way.
Yeah, we all make sounds and we have our mother tongue and we can do something with it. Can you tell us a little bit what you're doing now at the moment? So there's a rich musical life, but what keeps you busy?
Yeah, that's a big loaded question. And the funny thing is that I hardly play music at all anymore. And the last performance that I had was about a year ago.
Wow.
And so my life has gone through a lot of different stages, as you know, many people do. And you know, we had a little short conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I know you also have gone through all kinds of different iterations of your business and the things that you enjoy doing. And so, you know, I started out as an obsessed musician, a violinist, single-mindedly pursuing a solo violin career. And long story short, I changed direction when I was 19 and came kind of full circle during the pandemic when I made a solo violin recording. But in the time in between, the decades in between, I did everything but play solo violin. I was in orchestras, I was playing chamber music, I did some teaching. Played Baroque violin, all kinds of different things. And I think the solo kind of playing of the violin, it was so much a part of me from the time I was 2 years old that I ended up suffering a bit when I sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater and stopped doing what my soul really loves. And so I started suffering without realizing why. I think I didn't have the creative outlet. I wasn't being able to express myself in the same kind of way in those other situations. And I ended up having some neck pain. I just wasn't as happy. I had kids, I got married, and all of that was wonderful, but you know, it's also very difficult. And so I ended up having some physical issues and not being so happy. And then I found this wonderful thing called the Alexander Technique, which completely changed my life in pretty much every way. And so I started pursuing that, and I did a 3-year professional certification to become an Alexander Technique teacher. And I guess I got certified in 2007. And since then, I have been specializing in helping musicians, coaching musicians, to overcome all kinds of physical and emotional obstacles to really fully enjoying the music that they make and what they do on a daily basis in their everyday lives. So I coach musicians, and that has become my new obsession that's been lasting for the last couple decades. And I really, really love sharing this fascinating thing with people. Wow. So that's what I do now, 24/7, it feels like.
You know, in The Power of Music Thinking, so my hypothesis is that music and the way how you listen helps you a lot and also makes you who you are. And in that sense, I have conversations with people that have something with music, so all the listeners know. And I always invite people that when we have a talk like this, that they replace the word musician with yourself or with people or business people or society, mm-hmm. and just to see what it does. And coming back to your Alexander Technique, when I studied, I heard colleagues and friends talking about when they were learning an instrument or at conservatorio. And that was the first time I heard about Alexander Technique. And funny mm-hmm. enough, I never heard it out of the music context. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking always, if something can be so valuable for performers, and performer can be anyone, it can be an artist, it can be a business person, but okay, the most experience is from the musicians. Can you tell us what's the essence of the Alexander Technique, or anything that you think that might be interesting for everybody to hear?
Oh, absolutely. And this is what I love to talk about. So thank you for asking. That's why I'm here. Gosh, there's so much. It's a whole world. People in the arts world, not just music, you know, in all the arts tend to have heard of the Alexander technique because Alexander himself, who was born in 1869, way back, he was an actor. And so people first started hearing about it in the acting world. Probably just about all the famous actors that you, your listeners, anyone today has heard of, they've probably taken some Alexander technique lessons. And so Alexander really meant it for everyone. And it is helpful for anyone because, and I'm not so sure I can say the essence of the Alexander technique is in a couple words, but I think it's really about getting to know what your habitual ways of thinking and moving are and noticing, observing yourself to discover how your habits are getting in the way of your natural design and maybe making it a little harder for you to do what you want to do. So we learn how to notice with much more subtlety what we're actually doing to ourselves to create overall excess tension, which makes it then more difficult to be creative, more difficult to move literally, physically, because the mind and the body are not separate. And I think that's one of the most important things that Alexander discovered about how the mind and body work together. So they're not separate. The human being is a whole system, and every aspect of who we are influences every other aspect of ourselves. So how you think influences how you move and how you feel emotionally, and you can't really separate those out.
So the basic or the core sounds like it's some kind of self-observation, trying to have a different view on yourself, not just the view from outside of you, but also how you act and maybe also how you speak. All right.
Yeah. And that's where the origin of the technique comes from, because as an actor, Alexander had a problem. He became hoarse every time he got up on stage to recite. And he went to doctors and speech therapists. Nobody saw anything wrong with his vocal mechanism. And so he deduced logically that if there was nothing wrong with his physical body, there must be something that he was doing himself that was blocking the natural expression of his instrument, his voice. And so he decided to figure out what nobody else could help him. So he really, really wanted to perform. He had a very strong desire. And I think that's a very important thing to notice, that he really wanted to be a successful actor. Otherwise, you know, most people would have given up. Nobody could help him. And he literally spent years in front of mirrors to watch himself, observe himself, to try to figure out what he was doing to himself to cause the hoarseness.
Okay. Because in 1869, there was no video. Nowadays, you can just use your phone and put it in the corner, do what you do, and later watch what you did.
Yeah, I imagine if he'd had video. I mean, even at that time, people didn't have full-length mirrors. He went out and bought 3 full-length mirrors, which would be like for me to go out and buy some, you know, scientific equipment that normal people don't have. So, but he realized he needed to watch his whole body in these mirrors from different angles. And the story goes that it literally took years for him to observe. And he took copious notes on what he was observing and experiencing. He was very curious and he was experimenting, and he tried things out. They worked or they didn't. And ultimately he did figure out that it was how he was thinking that was causing a constriction in his physical body, which was then causing his muscles to tense up, and that caused the hoarseness.
Wow.
And then he, of course, if he was thinking in a certain way to get that result, he realized, well, I guess I need to experiment with thinking differently to get a different result. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, he figured out how to do that. And that's what today, you know, we don't have to figure it out from scratch because he did all that work. Thankfully, we don't have to watch ourselves in front of mirrors or even on a video camera for years. But we you know, have a system in place that can help us do a little bit of what he did.
Yeah, that's very, very special. In one of the early episodes with Gina Urthiva, she was a Bollywood singer, and she lost her voice at the top of her career. She talked in our conversation, she talked that this was for 1 year. She tried to find out what works for her, and then she came up with what she now calls musical hacks that she could get her voice better, and she's helping other people with it. So my question would be, is there one or two hacks that Alexander used, or how are you working with clients that come first to you? Are you observing them, or are you helping them to observe? Do you have three mirrors?
No. So actually, the way I teach is a little different now from how traditional Alexander technique teachers teach. So just a little bit more history of what happened is that when Alexander solved his vocal problem, then he started being a successful actor, and then people started coming to him to learn how to get the kind of voice he had. So he started teaching. Then he realized that the problem he was having was universal to pretty much all human beings. And then he branched out, starting to teach anyone, not just actors. Moved to London, started having some really prominent students like the Archbishop of Canterbury, Nicholas Tinbergen, who is a Nobel Prize winner, some really high profile people. And then people started to want to learn how to teach the way he was teaching. And he had gotten to the point where he felt that it was faster and easier for him to sort of illustrate the ideas by using touch. And so in the beginning, he wasn't using his hands. And obviously, when he figured out how to solve his own problems, he didn't have a teacher touching him. So clearly the method that he figured out for his discoveries had nothing to do with a kinesthetic experience with another person. But down the road, he added in an element of touch when he was teaching that he felt was really useful to illustrate the concepts. And so then when he started training people how to teach his method, he started to teach them how to also use their hands and touch their students and teach that way. So over the years, I mean, it's been a long time now since this method has been around since the early 20th century, and it's evolved quite a lot. And that was, I think, the first evolution from a no-touch system to a kinesthetic touch modality. And since he trained people with touch, then it became more and more that kind of a system. Now, when I was teaching this at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music to musicians, it was an interesting situation that I was in, because the university would only allow me to teach my students for one semester, which was very short. And I felt that it wasn't being fair to my students to have them rely on my touch, because then after one semester, they wouldn't have me anymore. And I wanted them to be more self-reliant and have things that they could do for themselves after they'd completed their work with me. So I started experimenting more with the ideas. And sort of back to the origins of what Alexander did for himself, and to figure out, well, can I help my students think differently to get different results for themselves, even if I'm not there in the room with them? And it was working, which was great. And then fast forward some years, and then I met Mio Morales, who is now my partner, my boyfriend, and he is a master Alexander Technique teacher who's been involved in the Alexander Technique for more than 50 years and was a bit ahead of me with experimenting without using touch. And, and before the pandemic, there were literally a handful of people in the whole world who were Alexander Technique trained teachers not using touch. It was very rare. So we hit it off when we met at a conference in Ireland because there were so few people and it was so exciting to talk to somebody else who was experimenting with the same stuff. And so he had already come up with this system that he keeps evolving, but it's called Primal Alexander. And there, it can be used with touch, but not, it's not really intended that way.
But how does it work?
So how does it work? Great. This is the great thing. So I can teach anyone, and I work exclusively online now since 2018, way before the pandemic. So the way it works is I am usually, it's possible to do this just through the auditory feedback that you can get on the phone, but I don't normally do that. So I'm looking at someone, like right now we're on Zoom and I can see you and you can see me. So there's a lot of information that's transmitted through our visual and energetic senses, whatever, whatever that is. I know that you are not just pixels on a screen. I have the sense that you're a real person, across the ocean, and I can observe certain things about my student, when I'm looking at them, and I can hear details in the tone, in the voice. So rather than the kinesthetic sense being my tool, it's more the what I observe through the auditory and visual senses, and also just a sort of an energetic sense to pick up information. And then I can give feedback to my student in the form of questions and, ideas to help my student become more in touch with what they're doing and thinking on the inside, and then sort of guide the student with questions and into an exploration that is actually quite systematic. It's not maybe as free for all as I'm making it sound.
To a few weeks ago, I finished a training about NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. Yes. And what you just described there, I see some equalities, and that's one question. And it's connected with another one. It's like when we talk about sound, we often talk about it's touching from a distance. So yes, you can touch people directly, you touch them with the music via the ears. Is this something that you're using?
Well, yes. If you think about it, everything is vibration. Light is vibration. Sound is vibration. We are made up of energy. And, there's all, I don't even remotely claim to know much about quantum physics, but, or quantum mechanics and all that, but I am curious about all that. And it makes a lot of sense that we are intimately connected, whether we see each other, hear each other, or, whatever senses we have, we are connected no matter where we are. I firmly believe that. That's my experience. And starting from that as a point of departure, if you are open to that possibility, well, then sure. When you play music, it sets things in motion that then will literally affect the listener, because literally their body, the molecules, like the energy that they are, is going to be moved, literally moved. And when you talk about being moved by music, usually we think about the emotions being moved. But what's an emotion? You can't have an emotion without your body. And it's all vibration. right? Emotion is, of course, chemicals, you know, coursing through your system also. But again, you can't separate the thoughts, the emotions, and the body. And the music is vibrations that then, you know, literally move whatever it is that we are. And the same goes for ideas, right? It's all just somehow affecting other people. Well, one thing that actually I'm very conscious of when I'm teaching is what scientists, neuroscientists have discovered about mirror neurons, where this is probably, I don't know much about NLP, but Mio has studied that, my part. So I know that there are a lot of similarities in Primal Alexander. But as far as the mirror neurons go, I mean, when you look at another person without even being aware of it, you are mirroring what that other person is manifesting. So if I get really tight, like I scrunch up my face and my body like I am right now, and you can hear it in my voice, it gets really tight. When you listen to that, you hear the different vibrations. And if you're seeing me, your body gets tight because you're mirroring that unconsciously. We are made for that kind of empathy.
Yeah, right. In NLP, you call this making rapport, but then you do it by purpose, just to make connection with the person and then try to change it.
So, that's right. And so that's the thing, is you can affect people unconsciously, and knowing that you can also learn how to consciously, you know, first do it for yourself, right? So if I want to take care of myself, and this is the how that you were asking me, you know, I have to be able to take care of myself first. And that means observing myself and being connected to what am I, like, asking myself with curiosity, what's happening to me right now as I'm sitting here? That's what Mio calls the primary concern. So my primary concern is to be curious, what's happening to me right now? And then I can notice, oh, well, maybe I have a little tension in the lower leg, left leg. Oh, well, that's interesting. There's no judgment there, but that's just interesting information. And then is there somewhere in my body that just feels a little less tense? Is there a place that's relatively quiet or easy or comfortable? And what you focus on, you get more of. So if I'm focusing on pain and discomfort, I will get tighter. And then the person I'm in contact with will pick that up. That's not good for either of us. If instead I'm curious about, well, what's already working inside of me? Where's the ease? Where's the freedom and the comfort and the natural, where things are working? Then I can access a bit of ease or flow. And when I do that for myself, then the person with me, seeing me or hearing me, is going to be influenced in a positive way by my taking care of myself. So that's in a nutshell how Primal Alexander works. It's like the first tiny little baby step, right? But that's the nutshell. And then I teach my students or my coaching clients how to recognize the very subtle things that's happening inside of themselves from moment to moment, to have more conscious, these are Alexander's words, more constructive, conscious control over themselves. And then the next stage would be, okay, well then how can I bring the ease that I'm in, the flow that I'm starting to experience within me, and it's growing because I can do that, I can expand that experience. How can I bring that into the work I'm doing, or the playing my instrument, or going into that meeting and having a conversation with my employees or my boss? And how can I bring my most creative, open, authentic self into whatever it is I'm doing?
Right. So business people would benefit from Alexander technique. By the way, I have a little bit, let's say, maybe a behavior. If I have a bad day, I get out and just smile to someone and they smile back. So it's like, and this does something with you. So it sounds like a stupid hack, but it's something like, okay, I have to start with something, and then you get something, and then you can Sometimes it helps and sometimes not. But
that's,
it's always
worth
trying.
That's a good one. And there's actually research on smiling, how it actually, even if you don't feel like smiling, if you do it, like fake it until you make it, it's like, or you act as if you're happy, something actually changes in the chemistry of your brain that it takes you in a different direction towards more happiness. So that's a really good hack.
Do it until you be it instead of fake it till we make it.
That's right. It's that act as if principle too.
and by the way, and that's performing as well. So that's the performance starts with you, and it's either in business or on the stage. It's like you have to be there and you have to embrace everything that's there. So you also play into a listening, like in a meeting, you speak into a listening because people want to hear what you say. Maybe not, but maybe they're at least they start with it. And that's a very, very powerful thing. And it's and performing is also some kind of embodiment. So you have to be there. You can't sit small on your and with your head hanging down and talk a pep talk, so to really motivate everyone. So you have to be there, and you not naturally have to fake it, but you have to be aware what it does to other people.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. But I've actually created what I call the art of freedom method for conscious living and masterful artistry. That's kind of my thing, where I get to be fully myself and I have the freedom to do whatever I want with the Alexander technique, with musicians, or if I decide tomorrow that I'm going to teach journalists, then I have the freedom to do that, because it's really about, for me, the essence of the Alexander technique, my method, everything is about what you just said, showing up and being fully authentically yourself, the best that you can. I mean, and who else could you be, really? But learning how to just observe and accept, and like with Suzuki, like I said before, nurtured by love, how can you really connect to that most central part of who we are, which I believe with all of my being, that is actually loving. And then we superimpose other thoughts and ideas that are not so loving that get in the way of our natural expression. And that causes fear and anxiety. And that will cause the whole system to shut down a little bit. That's where we do the pulling down that you were talking about, you know, where the posture is hunched over or tight, and we have performance anxiety. Lots of people come to me because they are physically in pain. They have neck pain, back pain, carpal tunnel, all those things, in addition to performance anxiety, lack of confidence, and because musicians, but these are things that all human beings experience. You know, if you're a CEO of a company, you know, you've had to learn or are in the process of learning how to have that open, responsive, confident presence, like you just described. And that is something that is natural to us, but we've learned how to interfere with that. We need to learn how to stop interfering and just be ourselves, our loving selves. And I think we'd have a lot less war in this world if we all learned a few of those skills.
Absolutely. And it's also, it also sounds like full circle. So we started with the Suzuki technique, and now we end at the Art of Freedom method. And there's the Alexander technique in between, and the touching from the distance. So that all makes sense. And you wrote a book, and I also will put the link into the show notes, because maybe just two sentences about the book. Is it what we talked about? It's touching everything that we had in our conversation?
Yes, and of course a lot more, because it's a hefty book. The book is called Make Great Music with Ease, The Secret to Smarter Practice, Confident Performance, and Living a Happier Life. And I've had a lot of people tell me that it's not just for musicians, that really, it's about being human and learning how to express yourself freely with joy and ease. The first part of the book talks about the challenges of being a musician, which anybody reading it could just translate like you said earlier, just substitute the word musician for writer or engineer or, you know, whoever this person is reading it, doesn't really matter. It's about the mental, emotional, spiritual, psychological, physical problems that can come up as a human being. And then there are lots of stories woven throughout the book about my experience as a musician, as a coach, Alexander technique teacher, and also my, you know, some ideas on spirituality, which are very universal. So there's that in there as well. I couldn't leave that out because for me, that's an essential part. That's where the love comes in. And then the third part of it in the book is the practical approach. And there are more tips and, like you said, hacks in there in the actual book, things that people can try out and practice. And the book actually comes with a video training that's free, which anybody could benefit from to learn. You know, I gave you just a teeny tiny little taste of the self-observational, you know, getting in touch with ease and tension in the body and starting to focus on more ease. I go into how to do that in the video training that comes with the book.
It sounds very music thinking, the way that I'm using music and just, yeah, put the analogy to everything in the world. And it sounds like a really, really interesting book. So I will put it in the show notes. Jennifer, thank you very much for sharing your insights. And thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to speak with you about all kinds of topics, music related and otherwise. Thanks, Krishna.
Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate this because listening is one of the top leadership skills, and I feel honored about this. It is my mission to find, create, and share inspirations for meaningful collaboration based on music analogies. If you want to support this, please subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating, or write a review on iTunes or Spotify. And more inspirations can be found on musicthinking.com. We have a blog, and you can download the Music Thinking Framework. And finally, I would love to hear your feedback. And if you need help with a business challenge, please reach out to me via email, podcast@musicthinking.com.